Hello and welcome to Public Health for the People with Dr. Amber. My name is Dr. Amber Schmidtke, and today we're going to be talking about COVID-19 disease trends in the state of Georgia. We're going to be talking about a newsletter that I'm launching for the state of Kansas, and we're also going to be talking about some upcoming opportunities for disease transmission, some events we want to be keeping an eye on, things like Halloween, the election season, and also the arrival of influenza season. So let's get right into it. First, we'll start with the discussion of testing. And you may have known that in the past, I've talked about how the arrival of the rapid antigen test is going to potentially complicate our view of what's happening with the pandemic. So far, the PCR test has been the gold standard for testing for confirming a case of COVID-19 throughout the United States. And so what this is doing is looking for the genetic fingerprint of the virus. And so for that reason, it's ultimately very, very accurate for finding what it's looking for. If it turns up positive, it is the thing. However, it can detect viral RNA, which is kind of analogous to our DNA, even when the virus is not functioning anymore, when it's no longer infectious. So it's very, very good at what it does, but it's almost too good at what it does, if you know what I mean. So there's also some problems in the fact that it takes a while to get that test result. Sample collection can be very invasive. It's the one that people joke, it feels like it's tickling your brain. And so there's, you know, maybe some apprehension among our population to get that test done, but it's also kind of expensive. And so in, you know, recent weeks, we've seen the advent of a new test called the rapid antigen test that is looking for viral proteins, those spiky looking things that are on the outside of all the graphics that you see for COVID-19. And what's nice about that is that if the test is able to detect that, those viral proteins are less hardy than the RNA. They don't stand up as well to heat and inactivation as well as the RNA does. And so if they're there for the test to detect, then that means that the virus is probably in full swing. It's probably active and infectious. And so there's some benefit to that. The other thing is that it functions in many ways like a home pregnancy test. So it doesn't require advanced equipment to do this test. You have results in about 15 minutes, and it's a lot cheaper than the PCR test. So you may be wondering why, if the rapid antigen test is as wonderful as it is, why isn't it being used to confirm cases? Why is it only being used to identify probable cases? And part of the reason is because it is not quite as reliable as the PCR test. In some ways, because it is so cheap, it may be the sort of thing that we can afford to do multiple tests to overcome that lack of reliability. But what's going on here is that it is as good as PCR at identifying positive cases. So you can trust a positive result that comes from this. However, it is not as good at detecting a negative or a true negative result from this test. So what I should say is you can't necessarily trust a negative result. And so for that reason, this test needs to be followed up by a PCR test if you do see a negative. And this is not that different from how we run like rapid strep tests. We go ahead and swab your throat. We can do the rapid test, but we can also send it for culture just to make sure that we haven't missed something that could be treated. So that's kind of how this kind of thing works. So as far as like having data that we can make actionable decisions with, there's an advantage to having this test. And so there's some concern that this is going to gain popularity among healthcare providers as they're trying to sort out who has COVID-19, who doesn't. And the thing about that is that as that test gains favor, will that happen at the expense of the PCR test, which is what the state of Georgia uses to confirm a case? And that's honestly the way that they report cases. They don't even consider things that are identified through other means. But recently, CDC changed the case definition, suggesting that we could now call these cases that are identified through these alternate test methods, especially the rapid antigen test, as probable cases. And the state of Georgia just started doing this. In fact, we got it in a county indicators report yesterday. And last week, through an open records request with the state, we were able to find out that since its arrival in the state of Georgia, the rapid antigen test has been performed over 73,000 times and reported to DPH so far. So that's just the ones that have been reported. So on a week-to-week basis, those tests account for 1 to 10% of the weekly tests that are being performed and reported since the 28th of June when they started collecting the data. So like I said, this now fits into the probable case definition, but if the state isn't communicating that to the public, isn't communicating it to external agencies that compare data across states, then we're not really seeing an apples-to-apples comparison. Then this week, through that county indicators report that I mentioned, we found out that there have been, of those 73,000 antigen tests that DPH is aware aware of, there have been 21,348 probable cases identified through things like rapid antigen testing and that probable case definition. And that's on top of the statewide total. So there's more disease than we previously realized. And what's interesting is if you look at a case-by-case sort of comparison, the impact varies by county. So statewide, if we combine the probable and the confirmed cases together, the rapid antigen tests account for up to 6.2% of the state's combined total of cases. For cases like Bibb and Chatham, so they're non-rural counties, but they're not part of the Atlanta Metro, it ranges from 1% to 2%. For a county like Athens-Clarke, which is home to the University of Georgia, the rapid antigen test accounts for 13.3% of the combined cases so far. The test is pretty well suited for places where you expect to find disease, places like nursing homes, colleges and universities, K through 12 settings, that sort of thing. So it's maybe not surprising that this test has gained more popularity in that community. However, if we don't know about it, that's kind of important, especially for locals that are trying to make informed decisions about the disease trends in their area. So again, these results still are not being counted in the state total. That means it's not being communicated to external agencies like the New York Times, the Atlantic's COVID Tracking Project, even the Georgia Geospatial Information Office. And so we're not getting that data in a way that is meaningful for the public, and we're not seeing an apples-to-apples comparison across states. Something weird happened this week. We moved in the national rankings from 33rd in the nation with 191 cases per 100,000 to 24th in the nation with 180 tests per 100,000. So we're doing less testing, but we moved up in the rankings. And I think this is an artifact of the way that rapid antigen testing is making that predicted impact on overall testing, since this tally only considers PCR testing. So again, it's kind of a weird thing to note, and we'll see what happens next week. So this week, the United States is ranked 20th in the world for case rate per 100,000 in the most recent 2 weeks. So far, we have had 7.4 million cases and 209,000 plus deaths as of Monday. It's important to remember that both of these are likely undercounts of our reality. It's a problem that plagues all of public health, but especially when you have a disease like this where so many cases are asymptomatic. The South generally is cooling off if we're trying to look at where the hotspots are located. That's a good thing. The hotspots are actually concentrated in the Midwest. And right now, Wisconsin in particular is ruby red, very red hot state. Georgia is no longer in the top 10, haven't been for a couple weeks now. In fact, we're ranked 30th in the nation for weekly case rate, and that's below the national average. However, there is a catch, and that has to do with that rapid antigen testing thing. If we're not submitting the same data as everybody else, we're not really comparable to everybody else. Last week, we reported just over 8,200 new cases, and despite our decline since the summer surge, which are definitely fantastic and worthy of celebration, we still remain at a high rate. It's about twice as high as where we were prior to the summer surge. So just remember that the momentum that we've worked hard to send into this downward trajectory has all of the fuel it needs to actually turn things around very quickly and head in the opposite direction, moving up if we are not careful and vigilant. Last week, cases decreased across all age groups and races. The exception was Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders, who saw a small increase. Last week, there were 685 new cases reported among healthcare workers, which is higher than the previous week. And again, we want to take care of this critical resource because, you know, they take care of us when we're sick. And if they're sidelined with disease, then we're a little bit more strapped for our own care. Turning to hospitalizations, Georgia has been working to decrease our rate through controlling the spread of illness. And what we had previously been at number one for several weeks, and then we went to number two for a couple weeks, but we're back to number one. 11.8% of our hospital beds are occupied by COVID-19 patients, and that's the highest rate in the country. It's just ahead of Mississippi, who has 11.5%. So we're not that much higher, but we are higher. The top three are Georgia, Mississippi, and South Dakota. Many new hospitalizations are decreasing across age groups, but we saw increases for the young, ages 5 to 29, as well as 50 to 59 year olds. Both new hospitalizations hospital admissions and new ICU admissions were down slightly from the previous week, but overall, ICU admissions have been trending up in the past 2 weeks. Current hospitalizations, which are less susceptible to that variation day to day, have continued to trend down slowly, which is a good thing, but we are still about 63% higher than we were prior to the summer surge. So again, we have to be careful to protect that momentum that we've worked hard to achieve in that downward trajectory. Moving on to deaths, I know it's the thing nobody wants to talk about, but it's an unfortunate thing that we do need to talk about because it's a part of this pandemic. Nationally, our weekly death rate is slightly down at 1.6 per 100,000. It was 1.6 last week, so being at 1.5 this week is really good. We are ranked 21st in the world, down from 20th last week. For Georgia, we are ranked number 13th in the nation for weekly death rate, down from number 7, and we have more than the national average at 2.1 deaths per 100,000. Five of the top 10 states are southern states. Last week, we reported 216 new deaths, which is a decrease from the previous week. And our death rate is about twice as high, more than twice as high in rural counties, than the state average. Case rate and death rate for rural counties and non-rural counties show us that Georgia is really facing two pandemics, the one that's affecting the Atlanta metro and the one that's affecting the rest of the state. Deaths are decreasing for all races, except for other, which includes the majority of people who identify as Hispanic or Latinx. Deaths are continuing to increase with age. So the older you get, the greater the deaths are. Most age categories saw a decrease last week. The exception was a modest increase among those who are 30 to 39. And then thinking again about our healthcare workers, last week or in the previous week, we saw 9 deaths, but in the most recent week, we saw only 3. So that's a good thing to see that number going down in that way. So to summarize, Georgia appears to be doing better in many ways, but since we aren't really seeing an apples to apples comparison with other states, as the majority of them are using the rapid antigen test results in their case and testing totals, whereas we are not, then you can't really make that comparison. And I should mention that all of the other southern states are doing this, so we're kind of this last remaining holdout. It's great that we're starting to get data on probable cases, including those that are identified through the rapid antigen test. But we need to see those data reflected in other parts of the daily report, especially testing data. Because as rapid antigen test gains in popularity at the possible expense of the PCR test, then the percent positive rate is going to matter less and less. And this will have important impacts on K through 12 and higher education, businesses, communities of worship, and healthcare infrastructure that use these criteria for decision making about reopening, phased reopenings, all of those sorts of things. So next, let's start thinking about some of these things that are coming up for us that are going to be possible contributors to disease spread. There's a lot of events coming up in the fall, and as people gather for them, it can increase our chances of disease. And the three that I want to talk about today are Halloween, the influenza season that is just around the corner, and the November election. So we'll talk about each of these. And so the CDC came out with guidance a couple weeks ago specific to Halloween, where they categorize different activities as low risk, moderate risk, or high risk. So things you're going to want to think about as you consider these activities is your family's personal risk budget in terms of how much risk are you able to take if you have people in your family with underlying conditions that might make them more susceptible to COVID-19 complications, then you're probably less willing to take risk than others. And so you would probably want to hang out in the low risk category as much as possible. For everybody else, I would highly discourage you from doing the high risk activities and instead hang out in the moderate risk activities. But just understand that it's a budget, right? When you think about your risk. So you don't want to overspend your risk. If you're taking a moderate risk in one area, you want to be low risk in your others because your risk accumulates altogether. Some of the activities that they list for Halloween that are low risk are things like carving and decorating your pumpkins at home or outside at a distance with friends, doing a Halloween scavenger hunt, maybe not on Halloween itself, but, you know, giving your family a list of things that you've noticed in the neighborhood or elsewhere that they need to go and try to find as they're walking the neighborhood, for example. You could do a virtual Halloween costume contest via Zoom, maybe with distant friends and family. relatives, that sort of thing. They also suggested a family movie night, you know, so kind of do it up big. And again, parents, the more that we can model our enthusiasm and excitement for this, the less painful and difficult it will be for the kids. So again, try to have a great attitude. Try to, you know, nobody wants to be doing Halloween this year this way. But if you are in that family category that needs to be doing low risk activities, the better attitude you have, the better your kids will deal with it. So if you are maybe not in a high risk family situation and you want to consider a moderate risk activity, some of the things that CDC indicates are things like one-way trick-or-treating with individually wrapped goodie bags. That means that everybody in the neighborhood agrees to just go down the street in one direction so you don't get a lot of cross traffic, and then having individual households doing goodie bags maybe at the end of a table, for example, and just make sure that you're using good hand hygiene as you're producing those goodie bags, washing your hands before and after working with them. They also suggested maybe a small group outdoor open air costume parade. So again, you're not really gathering with people, but you're sort of showing off your cool costumes. You're going to notice they want you to do as much outside as possible. Another thing they recommended was an outdoor costume party that includes masks and social distancing. If the weather's nice, and it often is in Georgia in October, that might be a successful enterprise. Just make sure that you're maintaining that 6-foot distance. They recognize that a lot of us like haunted forests. You will not be doing a haunted house if you want to stay in that moderate risk category, but you do want to make sure that you're still wearing masks and watching that 6-foot distance. They also have said that if screaming is more likely to occur, then you want to expand that distance from 6 feet to possibly as much as 10 to 12 feet. So they also suggested an outdoor Halloween movie night with local friends, and again, maintaining that 6-foot distance. Things that they denote as high risk include things like a traditional trick-or-treat where you go door-to-door, things like trunk-or-treat events, which may seem a little confusing because it's outside, right? And that should be okay. But really, these events tend to be very congested. There tends to be a lot of close contact, and so that's what I think they're trying to avoid. They also discourage and consider high risk things like indoor costume parties, indoor haunted houses, and even things like hay rides and tractor rides. So if you're going to go to the pumpkin patch, for example, I would recommend going during the week if you're able to do so, when the crowds are likely to be smaller. Avoid things like those hay rides and tractor rides, and maybe focus on other aspects of the pumpkin patch this year, admiring decorations, those sorts of things, but really try hard to keep those distances. And honestly, I'm not even sure if we're going to the pumpkin patch this year. But, you know, leave it to Americans. We come up with some pretty great things to overcome some of these challenges. I have seen some really neat videos and demonstrations of people who are making PVC pipe candy chutes. I think that is amazing. I've also seen people that have like a zip line to deliver candy to the kids. And I just admire the ingenuity of people to come up with these ideas. So you can find more about the CDC guidance if you just Google CDC, Halloween, and COVID. Those three keywords should take you to this guidance. The next thing I want to talk about is influenza season. So normally, this really starts to get going in November and lasts through March. But we, you know, sometimes it's those aren't hard and fast borders of the season. So it's important for us to try to monitor or to model the behavior that we want to see in our community. So if you are getting a flu shot, I'd encourage other people to get a flu shot too. And what I'm telling community leaders that I'm talking to is that in that modeling of behavior we want to see in our community, you know, post something on social media and say something like, I get my flu shot because, and fill in the blank, maybe with a selfie with your Band-Aid or lollipop or whatever it is that you do. There are some areas where they are doing drive-through flu shot clinics, and I think that is genius. I would highly encourage you to go ahead and get that flu shot, because we know that co-infections are possible with COVID-19, and we know that both diseases on their own can be fatal for certain people. So we don't want to have complicated infections where somebody has both, because it's not only bad for them, but they could be coughing for one reason and spreading the other illness at the same time. So we don't want that to be happening. The next thing I want to talk about, and we'll talk more about influenza as we get deeper into the season, but the time is now to go ahead and get that flu shot. The other thing I want to talk about is the upcoming November election. Obviously, this is a really important election for no matter who you are. And again, we want to try to model the behavior that we want to see in our communities. So if you are planning to vote, and I very much hope you are, share your voting plan, including how you are thinking through the risk of this. So, you know, if you are a person that has a high risk condition, then you probably might want to consider the use of an absentee ballot where, you know, your risk of interaction is less. You can drop off those ballots at different locations. There's usually one per county, at least, those sorts of things. The next layer is do early voting. If you want to vote in person, try to do early voting and try to take advantage of their Monday through Friday hours when they will not be quite as crowded. I understand that that's not going to be an option for everybody, but try to take advantage of early voting in whatever capacity prior to Election Day, because we expect the crowds on Election Day to be significant. But if all of that fails, and you're the sort of person that says, I don't have a lot of high risk issues going on, and it's just a tradition for me to always vote on Election Day. Okay, great. I want you to vote no matter what. And so I would just make sure to encourage you to wear your mask, to observe that 6-foot distance, to take advantage of hand washing and hand sanitizing stations wherever they're available, maybe carry your own hand sanitizer, and be prepared to wait in line. So, you know, if that means bringing a small folding chair for yourself or making sure that you have a snack, that you, you know, take off your mask briefly just to eat it real quick and then put your mask right back on, those sorts of things. But we really need to be thinking through the risk mitigation of these sorts of things, because we really don't want this to be a super spreader event. So again, do your best with this and really think through how you're going to manage those risks. Okay, guys, this has been a longer chat than usual. So I will just remind you that the conversation doesn't end here. If you'd like to get in touch with me to talk about any of these issues, I have two newsletters going now. The one for Georgia is amberschmidtkeyphd.substack.com. And the one for Kansas is called kansascovid19updates.substack.com. So the whole words are spelled out except for 19, which is 19. And you can also find me on Facebook and Twitter, where we can have more of a back and forth conversation. So thank you so much, guys, for listening. And we'll be back next week to talk more COVID.